terrible disaster is about to befall Israel, and the people are none the wiser. And King Saul has determined that the priesthood set apart to serve Jehovah is going to be exterminated. That means that the word of God, as well as all of the vital ritual observances for cleansing and atonement, these are going to no longer be available to them. I've stated from the beginning of our study on Samuel that King Saul was not merely a poor choice for a king, nor does he represent a failed king. King Saul is the anti-king. King Saul is everything that humans desire and that God hates. Governmental leader. King Saul was real, and what we read about him is true, and it happened. But he's also a shadow, he's a type, and he established a pattern for the great Antichrist who's about to appear in our present era. Now, King Saul was among the most beautiful of men, we're told. He was a head and shoulders taller than any other man of his tribe, perhaps in all Israel. He was handsome, he was strong, he was charismatic, with a natural bent for knowing how to manipulate and to control. But he quickly abandoned the ways of his creator for the ways of the human evil inclination and the spiritual dark side. Now, it was expected that as long as King Saul had no rival and he didn't feel threatened, then his actions, while self-serving, wouldn't be terribly radical or seem suspicious to the Israelites at large. Saul's behavior and his decisions were no different than the behavior and decisions of all the neighboring nations and their governments. But as soon as David arrived on the scene, Saul knew that his time was near. His reign was threatened. And so his true nature was suddenly exposed. Now, this is generally what we read about the coming Antichrist, who will rise to international prominence and receive the adulation of the world. And apparently, even of the greatest portion of the institutional church, all having been deceived, because they had so long ago gone without the light of God's truth being taught to them. But it is when Yeshua's messengers, and then Yeshua himself makes their appearance, that all hell breaks loose, literally, on planet Earth, as Satan's eternal rival is now finally here to challenge him. The rhetorical question is a timeless one. How is it that Satan, who scriptures tell us at one time lived in heaven, in close proximity to God, as the most beautiful, the most intelligent, next to God, of all the heavenly creatures, how could he not only rebel against his master and his creator, but honestly believe that he could defeat God? How could Satan not understand to his core that because of his choice to try and place himself on God's throne, that the only possible ending for him was eternal destruction? How could he not know that? Well, we see that same scenario being played out in 1 Samuel, as King Saul is fully aware that God has not only removed the throne of Israel from him, but he has also completely and permanently abandoned him. King Saul is now God's eternal enemy. Did Saul honestly believe that he could defeat God's will and then hang on to that earthly throne? Did Saul seriously think he could kill off David's anointed one, or rather kill off God's anointed one, David, in order to keep David from assuming his God-ordained destiny as king over God's kingdom. See, the problem with Satan, the problem with Saul, the problem with all leaders of government who think that they can supplant God's justice and truth and morality with their own is a deep-seated spiritual irrationality. For the world, and especially for the elitist intelligentsia, these human leaders seem to be nearly infallible and undefeatable. Men to be followed without question, if not outright worshipped. So for us as believers to think of Satan as irrational is kind of hard to do when we see what he's accomplished over the last 6,000 years. But it's not so hard for us to see Saul as irrational. And so perhaps that's why such an extensive account of his life and his reign have been preserved for us in the Bible. It's so we can know what signs to look for, how to prepare when that coming evil world leader springs onto the scene. Therefore, just as King Saul decided that to eradicate opposition, he had to eradicate the priesthood, so will the Antichrist decide that to eradicate opposition, he must eradicate the priesthood of the modern era, the priesthood of believers in Christ. His solution? Take on the mark of the beast or die. Let's reread part of 1 Samuel 22. 1 Samuel chapter 22. You have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 323. We're going to read starting at verse 16 and take it to the end. So I guess that would be the next page, 324. But the king said, "You must die, you and your father's whole family." And then the king told the guards standing around him, "Go around and kill the priests of Adonai because they're siding with David, because they knew he was escaping, but they didn't tell me." But the king's servants refused to lift their hands against the Kohanim, the priests of Adonai. So the king went to Doeg. "You go and kill the priests." And Doeg the Edomite went around and he fell on the priests. And that day he killed 85 persons wearing linen ritual vests. He also attacked Nob, the city of the priests, with the sword. He put to the sword both men and women, children and babies, cattle, donkeys, and sheep. One of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and he fled to join David. Abiathar told David that Shaul had killed the priests of Adonai, and David said to Abiathar, "I knew it. That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he'd tell Saul. I caused the death of every person in your father's family. But stay with me. Don't be afraid, because the one who is seeking my life seeks yours too. You'll be safe with me." King Saul has ordered the end of the Levitical priesthood. He tries to get some of his Benjamite government council to do the dirty job for him. But as corrupted as they are, even they aren't willing to go that far. So Saul turns to a foreigner, an Edomite, to accomplish this evil deed. Doeg is anxious, he's willing. And so he begins with killing all 85 priests, and then in Machiavellian style, he murders all of their families. To send a message to anyone who might think to rise up and oppose the king, even the infant children of the Levite priests and their livestock are destroyed. Now, we covered this last week, but I want to reiterate that because the Bible presents us with progressive patterns, we ought to look closely not just at Saul, but also his main henchman, Doeg. Doeg was a descendant of Edom, Esau. And the Bible has much to say about the character and the destiny of Edom. Therefore, it's not surprising to learn that when David's descendant Yeshua was born 1,000 years after King Saul, another Edomite sought to kill those who would follow him. And that Edomite was King Herod. Now, I propose to you that it certainly seems possible, if not probable, that the so-called false prophet, the main henchman of the coming Antichrist, will be of Edomite descent. I'm not called to be a prophecy teacher. I have no claim to foresee the future. But occasionally, there's no bypassing it. And so I want to take a brief detour to examine this major Bible prophecy concerning Edom. Because it is entirely possible that some of us in this room may still be living when this prophecy occurs in all its fullness. So turn your Bibles to the book of Obadiah. This book is only 21 verses long, so we're going to read it all. The book of Obadiah. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 742. 742. This is the vision of Obadiah. Here is what Adonai Elohim says about Edom. As a messenger was being sent among the nations saying, "Come on, let's attack her," we heard a message from Adonai. "I am making you the least of all nations. You will be beneath contempt. Your proud heart has deceived you. You whose homes are caves in the cliffs, who live on the heights, and you say to yourselves, 'Who can bring me down to the ground?' If you make your nest as high as an eagle's, even if you place it among the stars, I will bring you down from there," says Adonai. "If thieves were to come to you, or if robbers by night, oh, how destroyed you are, wouldn't they stop when they'd stolen enough? If grape pickers came to you, wouldn't they leave some grapes for gleaning? But see how Esau has been looted, their secret treasures searched out. Your allies went with you only to the border. Those at peace with you deceived and defeated you. Those who ate your food set a trap for you, and you couldn't discern it. When that day comes," says Adonai, "won't I destroy all the wise men of Edom and leave no discernment on Mount Esau? Your warriors, Teman, will be so distraught that everyone on Mount Esau will be slaughtered. For the violence done to your kinsman Jacob, shame will cover over you, and you will be forever cut off. On that day, you stood aside while strangers carried off his treasure, foreigners entered his gates to cast lots for Jerusalem. You were no different from them. You shouldn't have gloated over your kinsmen on their day of disaster, or rejoiced over the people of Judah on their day of destruction. You shouldn't have spoken arrogantly on a day of trouble, or entered the gates of my people on their day of calamity. No, you shouldn't have gloated over their suffering on their day of calamity, or laid hands on their treasure on their day of calamity. You shouldn't have stood at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, or handed over their survivors on a day of trouble. For the day of Adonai is near for all nations. As you did, it will be done to you. Your dealings will come back on your own head. For just as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so will all the nations drink in turn. Yes, they will drink. They'll gulp it down. It will be as if they never existed. But on Mount Zion, there will be a holy remnant who will escape, and the house of Jacob will repossess their rightful inheritance. The house of Jacob will be a fire the house of Joseph aflame, setting aflame and consuming the stubble, which is the house of Esau. None of the house of Esau will remain, for Adonai has spoken. Those in the Negev will repossess the mountain of Esau, and those in the Shephelah, the land of the Philistines. They will repossess the field of Ephraim and the field of Shomron, Samaria, and Benjamin will occupy Gilead. Those from this army of the people of Israel, exiled from among the Canaanim as far away as Tzarfat, the exiles from Jerusalem and Sepharad will repossess the cities in the Negev, and then the victorious will ascend Mount Zion to rule over Mount Esau, but the kingship will belong to Adonai. The famous place called Petra, now part of Jordan, was in Egypt. Thus, in the first few verses of Obadiah, we read of you whose homes are caves in the cliffs. This is referring to Petra and surrounds. Now, I've been there, and I've taken several people to see it. And the size and the scope of it takes your breath away. Although Edom and Israel were related through Esau and Jacob, there was constant warfare between the two countries. David was the first Israelite king to conquer Edom. Edom revolted in the days of King Joram, installing its own king. And then years later, Amaziah reconquered Edom, and it wasn't until the days of Ahaz that the country regained its independence. In the 6th century BC, Edom was conquered by the Babylonians. Edom is going to play a major role in the end times, regardless of what modern name it might go by. And it seems clear that a very prominent Edomite will also play a major role in trying to defeat the returning Messiah, just as it happened at least twice in the past, one of which we're reading about right now in 1 Samuel. Now, it may be that Doeg was the first of this type and this shadow. Now, this bears repeating. While on the surface, this is all about King Saul committing personal retribution against Ahimelech, who Saul felt was siding with David. This was all a ruse. Saul was looking for an excuse to abolish the priesthood. After all, what possible use could a man who is God's enemy have for a group of men whose job it is to discern God's will and then teach it to God's people and to carry out God's ritual law? It has been the ways of men since time immemorial to create false crises and to come up with an excuse to carry out some kind of governmental act that actually disguises a much broader and more sinister design and intent. If King Saul was going to defeat God, he would have to begin by eradicating God's servants. Ecclesia, fellowship, for those who have an ear, pay attention to what I just told you, please. Inevitably, the greatest danger always comes from within, not from without. But God being God, he saved a remnant of one. Abiathar. Abiathar was Ahimelech's son, likely in line to be the next high priest. Somehow, he escaped the slaughter of the priests of Nob, and he fled to David for protection. Now, I doubt Abiathar realized it at the time, but what happened at Nob was merely a fulfillment of something that had been prophesied several years earlier. Now, let's recall that prediction by looking back at 1 Samuel chapter 2, 1 Samuel chapter 2. In verses 27 through 36. Starts on page 300 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. A man of God came to Eli and told him, "Here is what Adonai says. Didn't I reveal myself to your ancestors' clan when they were in Egypt, serving as slaves in Pharaoh's household? Didn't I choose him of all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear a ritual vest in my presence? Didn't I assign to your ancestors' clan all the offerings of the people of Israel made by fire? So, why are you showing such disrespect for my sacrifices and offerings, which I ordered to be made in my dwelling? Why do you show more honor to your sons than to me, making yourselves fat with the choicest parts of all the offerings of Israel, my people? Therefore, Adonai, the God of Israel, says, I did indeed say that your family and your father's family would walk in my presence forever. But now, Adonai says, forget it. I respect those who respect me, but those who despise me will meet with contempt. The day is coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's family, so that no one in your family will live to old age. At a time when Israel is prospering, you will see a rival in my dwelling, and never will anyone in your family live to old age. Still, I won't cut off every one of your men from my altar, because that would make your eyes grow dim and you would waste away. Nevertheless, all of your descendants will die young. Your sign that this will occur will be what happens when your two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, they will both die on the same day. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do what I want and what I intend. I'll make his family faithful. He'll serve in the presence of my anointed one forever. Everyone left in your family will come and prostrate himself before him for a silver coin or a loaf of bread and say, please, won't you give me some work as a priest so that I can have a scrap of bread to eat? There are a couple of critical lessons and principles in this chapter, the truth of which is now being made manifest in the later chapters of Samuel. First of all, is the principle contained in chapter 2, verse 30, and when it applied to Eli's descendants, it also applies to all believers in every age. 1 Samuel 2, 30 says, therefore Adonai, the God of Israel, says, I did indeed say that your family and your father's family would walk in my presence forever, but now Adonai says, forget it. I respect those who respect me, but those who despise me will meet with contempt. The number one requirement to receive God's promised blessings is abiding trust and respect. When that ends, the promised blessings end with it. I can't say it strongly enough. This is not about belief. Eli's family did not stop believing in Yahweh, God of Israel, but they did pervert their worship of him. They did add sufficient paganism and man-made traditions and personal wants and desires to their lives that God counted it as lack of trust and respect. Now, where is that line exactly? We dare not cross over. I don't know. No man knows. But when a man crosses over it, then expulsion from the kingdom is the divine response. Romans, New Testament, Romans 11, 19. So you'll say, well, branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. True, but so what? They're broken off because of their lack of trust. However, you only keep your place because of your trust. So don't be arrogant. On the contrary, be terrified. The second lesson is found in 1 Samuel, verse 32. Where it says, at a time when Israel is prospering, then you will see a light hole in my dwelling, and never will anyone in your family live to old age. Indeed, Eli's family had a rival. There was another high priest and a priestly family in existence. It was called the family of Zadok. Eli and his descendants were of the line of Ithamar. That was one of Aaron's sons. But they weren't supposed to be the high priestly line. Rather, the descendants of Eleazar were to produce the high priest. Zadok were the descendants of Eleazar. And even though Zadok became the high priest, David allowed Abiathar to continue to serve. So there were rival high priests for a while, even though apparently Zadok held more power. Now that would all be remedied when Solomon, who followed David, if he felt no loyalty to Abiathar, deposed him. Then only Zadok remained in office. So here we see how the Lord allowed a terrible evil perpetrated by an alliance between a Hebrew and a foreigner to be committed upon the priesthood. Yet this terrible evil not only punished what was actually a technically illegitimate line of priests, but by wiping them all out except for one, it now paved the way for the much smaller and less powerful line of Zadok to ascend back to their rightful, legitimate place. In the later chapters, we're going to see David appoint Zadok as high priest to kind of complete that circle. Now, the lesson. Just because an institution that claims to be of God is divinely allowed to exist and to prosper for a long time, or in some outward manner it seems to follow his ways, that doesn't mean that it is legitimate, and it doesn't mean it will always prosper. It may just be a tool for the Lord to achieve his will, just as it was with Pharaoh. A religious veneer often hides a false core that one day gets exposed. Well, when Abiathar arrived at David's encampment with this devastating news, David instantly knew that his own lies and deceptions and his lack of concern for the people of Nob led to their murder. And he openly admitted it, and he pledged to guard and to care for the only surviving priest from Nob, Abiathar. Not only that, but David now had in his charge the sole remaining link to Yahweh, so that along with that ritual vest that carried the precious Urim and Thummim stones, David now had a means to discern God's will. Let's move on to 1 Samuel chapter 23. 1 Samuel chapter 23. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 320. David was told, the Philistines are fighting Keilah and plundering the threshing floors. And David consulted Adonai, asking, should I go and attack these Philistines? And Adonai answered David, go, attack the Philistines and save Keilah. And David's men said to him, look, we're already afraid here in Judah. How much more than if we go to Keilah and fight the armies of the Philistines? And David consulted Adonai again, and Adonai answered him, set out and go down to Keilah, because I will hand the Philistines over to you. David and his men went to Keilah and fought the Philistines. They defeated them in a great slaughter, led away their livestock. Thus David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. Now when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David in Keilah, he brought a ritual vest with him. And now Shaul, on being informed that David had gone to Keilah, and said, God has put him into my hands. He's trapped himself by entering a town with gates and with bars. So Saul summoned all the people of war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. Now David knew that Saul was plotting something against him. So he told Abiathar the priest, bring the ritual vest here. Then David said, Adonai, God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul intends to come to Keilah and destroy the city just to get me. Will the men of Keilah turn me over to him? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? Adonai, God of Israel, please tell your servant. And Adonai said, he will come down. And then David asked, will the men of Keilah hand me and my men over to Saul? And Adonai said, they will hand you. So David and his men, now about 600, got up and left Keilah and went wherever they could. It was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he called off the expedition. And David stayed in the desert strongholds, remaining in the hills of the Ziph desert. Saul kept trying to find him, but God did not hand him over to him. Now David saw that Saul had mounted another expedition to seek his life, and David was then at Horesh in the Ziph desert. And Jonathan, Saul's son, set out and went to David at Horesh to encourage him in God. And he said to him, don't be afraid, because my father's forces won't find you. You will be king over Israel, and I'll be second to you. Saul, my father, knows this too. And then the two of them made a covenant in the presence of Adonai, after which David stayed at Horesh, and Jonathan returned home. The people of Ziph came to Shaul and Giba and said, David is hiding himself with us in the strongholds at Horesh, at Hakalah Hill, south of Yeshmon. So now, king, since you wanted so much to come down, come down. Our part will be to turn him over to you. And Saul said, oh, may Adonai bless you for showing me compassion. Please go, make still more certain exactly where he is and who has seen him there, because I've been told he's very tricky. So look closely, find out where all of his hiding places are, and then come back when you're sure, and then I'll go with you. And if he's there in that territory, I'll search until I find him among all the thousands of Judah. Well, they set out. They went to Ziph before Saul, but David and his men had got on to the Maon desert in the Arabah, south of Yeshimon. Saul and his men went searching for him. David was told. So he came down to the rock, and he stayed in the Maon desert. And when Saul heard that, he pursued David in the Maon desert. Saul went along on one side of the mountain, while David and his men went along on the other. Now David was hurrying to get away from Saul, while Saul and his men were trying to surround David and his men in order to capture them. But then a messenger came to Saul, saying, hurry, come, the Philistines are invading the country. So Saul stopped chasing David and went to fight the Philistines. Therefore they call that place Selah Hamachlor, rock of divisions. Now David was probably still somewhere in or around an area called the forest or the woods of Hereth. That's located in the region of Judah called the Shephelah. Now the Shephelah is the coastal plains all along Judah. Coastal plains being the Mediterranean coast. Scholars have had a difficult time locating this area. In fact, some doubt that this area of woods ever even existed, because none was known there for at least the past several hundred years. But they didn't take two things into account. First, the land only prospers and remains fertile when God's people are living in it. That's the spiritual influence. And second, the trees were intentionally cut down. They were eradicated by men, the fleshly, physical influence. See, once Muslim rule over the area began, which is about the 8th century, one of the primary means of taxation to support the caliphate was a tree tax. Every tree on a piece of land had a levy placed on it. Since much of the land was owned by absentee Muslim landlords who had no interest in the productivity of the land that they owned, or they didn't have any interest in contributing to the caliphate's coffers, they ordered all the trees cut down. No trees, no taxes. Thus, vast tracts of wooded areas disappeared. Now, this, of course, hastened soil erosion. And before long, the Holy Land was denuded of its vegetation, kind of like it is in modern day Haiti. They couldn't grow any but the poorest of crops because the exposed topsoil was now blown away in the seasonal dry winds. But a couple of decades, the land became useless. It was either swamps or desert, and it remained that way until the Jews returned, reforested the land, and turned it into the beautiful place that we visit today. David received word that the Philistines were attacking Keilah and plundering the threshing floors. Now, the place of Keilah is pretty well known, and the modern-day town of Kirbet Keilah is located about 8 miles southwest of Hebron, is that place. Now, technically, Keilah was part of Judah. However, at that particular time, it was under Philistine military control. Now, the city of Keilah was a walled city, but notice that it is not what was being attacked. The threshing floors were what was being attacked. The threshing floors were the targets of the Philistines, not the city and not the inhabitants. The threshing floors were always outside the cities and the towns, next to the fields. See, the Philistines weren't interested in land acquisition or in empire building. They also weren't mindless barbarians that rather enjoyed destroying things and creating mayhem. Rather, what they were after always was to lord over areas in order to control commerce, and so then they would gain economically. They were coming to Keilah for one purpose, to confiscate the grain. That means that harvesting was almost complete and the threshing process had begun. It would have been pointless to attack while the grain was immature or still in the fields on the stalk. They wanted the grain because they could capture it without doing very much work. Then they could turn right around and sell it to their own people and abroad. The Philistines were in the shipping business and they needed a ready supply of goods and commodities. Plundering it from their neighbors and then turning around and selling it, well, that was the common method of the era. To destroy cities and villages and fields would have been totally counterproductive. Now, verse 2 seems straightforward enough, but there's a little hidden gem in the first three words. It says, David consulted Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah. Immediately thereafter, the question asked of God is recorded for us. Should I go and attack these Philistines? Meaning at Keilah. See, to inquire of God is most often to employ these two ritual stones called the Urim and Thummim. These were stored inside a special pocket that was sewn into the high priest's ritual vest. And sure enough, we're told in verse 6 that Abiathar had brought his father's, Ahimelech's, ritual vest with him when he came to David. Now, one giveaway in scripture to help determine if an inquiry involved the Urim and Thummim is the format of the question. It has to be binary. In other words, only two answers are possible, yes or no. Left or right, up or down, go, stay. That's the only way it could ever be. The answer God gave by means of the two ritual stones was, yes, David, go ahead and attack the Philistines who were plundering the grain from Keilah. Now, David had no doubt, but the refugees from Saul who were with him in the woods of Hereth, well, they weren't quite in that same frame of mind. Here they were trying to elude Saul and stay alive, and now they're supposed to become a militia and go off and fight the Philistines? For what? Why? What do they get out of it? The resistance of the people sends David back to Abiathar and the two stones, Urim and the Thummim, and he asks, The Lord now has a similar question about what the result of this excursion would be because the people are afraid. God says he'll hand the Philistines over to David. Now let me caution you that the words with quotes around it in our Bibles that makes it appear that these are the words that Jehovah spoke to David are in fact what an editor wrote. They're called a gloss. And the effect and meaning of the Lord's response is entirely true. But remember now, this inquiry is through the Urim and Thummim stones. The stones did not speak. And there's no evidence that God spoke to David face to face and audibly. Rather, the stones answered a question that was structured to give a yes or a no answer. Perhaps maybe one glowed, the other didn't. It's not really known how it worked. So David must have asked something to the effect of, will we win? With the answer being, yes. Well, David went back to the men. And they followed in the Keilah where a great victory was achieved. Now, it's interesting that livestock of the Philistines is mentioned. A good question would be, why is Philistine livestock present here in the battle? The answer is that probably they brought the animals to graze in the fields that had just been harvested. We have to not so much picture the Philistines as a hardened army coming to fight a war, but rather an armed contingent of men simply arriving in a show of force in order to confiscate this grain over a several day period. And then during that time, they would let their cattle graze and fatten up a little bit on the leftovers. Now, I suspect there was a mixture of Philistine soldiers to more or less act as guards and intimidators to oversee a large contingent of Philistine civilian workers to gather up all of this confiscated grain to prepare it for shipment. There is also a result of this episode that, although not spoken, would have been well understood. David acted as a king. He led the people into battle. He rescued a town of fellow Judahites from the enemy. Verse 7 says, the king Saul got word about Abiathar fleeing to David and David leading some men to rescue Keilah. Saul's response was that this afforded him a good opportunity to capture David because David would have been trapped inside a walled city. But there's even more here. The delusional king actually believed that the God of Israel had effectively handed David over to him. More literally, verse 7 has Saul saying, God has alienated him, meaning David, from myself and into my hand. What chutzpah! Saul thinks the Lord has rejected his own anointed king in favor of the anti-king. From Saul's viewpoint, all he had to do was to send a sizable battalion of troops around the city and demand that David be handed over to him. If the city closed the gates and refused, then Saul's troops just put the city under siege. They probably wouldn't attack it. They just waited out till the city folks ran out of food and water or both. Time was on Saul's side. Now for Saul, the David would be trapped inside Keilah was sufficient for now. Sooner or later, David wouldn't have any choice but to surrender. David figured that Saul was going to do something. But because news of David rescuing Saul and saving the food supply would have spread like wildfire. So David, from inside the walled city of Keilah, summons Abiathar the priest, has him consult the Urim and Thummim with a couple of yes-no questions. The first question was if King Saul would bring troops to try to capture David there. And God's answer was, yes, he will. The second question was, if Saul and his troops showed up, would the people of Keilah turn David over to Saul? God's answer was, yep, they will. Well, with that information, David gathered his men, now numbering about 600, and they left Keilah. Now, I wonder how David must have felt knowing that the citizens of Keilah would so readily give him up after he risked his own life and the lives of 600 men to rescue them. How quickly the people who benefited from David's selfless act on their behalf were ready to turn their backs on him. But is this not typical of the way that both the type of Messiah, David, and the actual Messiah, Yeshua, would be treated by the very people that should have rallied around them in gratitude and in love? David and his 600 flee now to the great expanse of wilderness that is the Judean desert, and we'll follow him there next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them, merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.